Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up on the show today, a court ruling could strike a devastating blow to Seattle's homeless camp cleanups, at least those cleanups that they're willing to actually do. Plus, an update from our friend Jonathan Cho on the inferno that engulfed a wooded homeless encampment in downtown Seattle. Could it have been tied to a drug beef? He suspects so, and he's going to ask Seattle's mayor just that. Also, Governor Jay Inslee's story is so twisted on gas price, the gas prices that his own staff can't get their story straight. And hot today, wow. And our friend Jason Rance is going to stop by to talk about his new book, What's Killing America. If you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, please do so. It's how we make this show possible. You can sign up at undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. It's just $5 a month. What a screaming bargain. All right, first, Seattle has an issue. Well, many issues. But one of its many issues are judges getting in the way of what little progress Seattle is willing to muster. We talked on the show a few weeks ago about how a federal court judge in Seattle ruled that as it was written, the city's law around graffiti arrest and removal was unconstitutional, which is wild. So you have graffiti all over the place, and Seattle was barred temporarily from enforcing the statute. And that had been a bummer because, you know, some people say, oh, it's just graffiti, graffiti. But people who've been paying attention over the last 3 years have seen that all the public spaces in Seattle, the overpasses, are just covered with graffiti. And I'm sorry, but it makes the city look awful. And I do believe in the broken windows theory. And you had a mayor, Bruce Harrell, who said that he was going to make cleaning up graffiti a priority. And then you had a ruling like that. Well, there is a second ruling that, again, threatens what little progress Seattle is willing to make, what little political will the city has to make a difference. As you guys know, and I have been giving Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell credit for his willingness to clean up homeless encampments. Although his office is dodging us, which is odd because I've been stunningly kind to the mayor of Seattle. But that aside, there is a judge in Seattle, King County judge, and a ruling came down that essentially found that part of Seattle's encampment clearing rules are unconstitutional. This is the article from the Seattle Times. The article reads in part, the American Civil Liberties Union of Washington filed the lawsuit in 2019 on behalf of people who had belongings taken by the city of Seattle during encampment clearings. Sometimes those clearings happened with little to no warning, and much of their property was destroyed rather than stored, the plaintiffs claimed. Under the city's rules, clearings can be expedited like this if a tent, structure, or encampment is deemed an obstruction. But what exactly the city is allowed to place under that obstruction category has become one of the major linchpins in this case. The article goes on to read, this month, Superior Court Judge David Keenan issued a partial summary judgment calling the city's definition of obstruction too broad. Keenan wrote that under Seattle's current obstruction definition, it can be unfairly applied to people in tents who aren't actual real obstructions to the functions of the city or the general public, for the love of God. So here's what bothers me about all of this, besides it just making no sense at all. Seattle is incredibly delicate when it clears homeless encampments. Even if the Stop the Sweeps crowd and the activists don't think so, Seattle goes and has always gone to great lengths to try to offer services to individuals who are in camps long before the camp is swept. Seattle has gone to great lengths to give people camping, again, on property that's not theirs, 72 hours to clear their stuff, to move it somewhere else, to accept access to services before they're swept out. And so the idea, the mere notion that Seattle is this heartless institution that just is going in and tearing homeless people out of the place where they're at is ridiculous. It's just absurd. And what's odd about this ruling is it seems to suggest that the mere act of having a tent on a sidewalk or having a tent in a public park is not in and of itself an obstruction. So what the judge is basically saying is that it's too broad in the sense that if you have a tent that's on a sidewalk, but people can still get around it, is that really an obstruction? And I would say yes. It is a tent in the middle of a sidewalk on a public right-of-way. The same is true with the park. If you have a public park that is there for the enjoyment of citizens, that's there for kids to play, for dogs to run around, whatever it is, and you have a tent anywhere in that park, that is an obstruction to the use of the park. But the judge is saying, well, that's not necessarily the case. If it's not an actual, it says, it follows that under the obstruction definition, the city can remove a tent or person anywhere in the park and anywhere on a public sidewalk, irrespective of actual obstruction, which is such a weird interpretation of obstruction. If a tent is somewhere in a public right-of-way where it is not legally allowed to be, that is an obstruction. So here you have these rulings, the graffiti ruling, the removal of encampment ruling, that to me is threatening what little progress Seattle is willing to make, what little political will Seattle has, is for nothing when you have activist judges making rulings like this one. And we already know the consequences of not clearing out encampments. Encampments in and of themselves have the biggest causal tie to shootings in the city of Seattle, more than domestic violence, more than gang violence. The single biggest tie when it comes to a shooting is some sort of link to homelessness. Either the victim was homeless, the perpetrator was homeless, the shooting happened in or around a homeless encampment. And so there are so many issues that come along with allowing encampments to form anywhere in the city. And I think this next story is we have an update to a story we discussed yesterday, is a perfect example of the danger of leaving encampments in place and the danger of judges making it more difficult for politicians who have the will to remove encampments to do so. So we talked yesterday about how over the weekend, you've probably seen the video of this, we showed it on the podcast yesterday, there was this inferno of a fire in a little green space along Fifth Avenue in downtown Seattle, right by Harborview Medical Center. And there had been an encampment there that has been problematic. And surprise of the century, it's an encampment that's on State Department of Transportation property. And so you're in this weird gray area where the city's like, well, we would clear it, but we can't because it's on state property. So anyway, there was this massive inferno and just boom, explosions, and the trees just went up in flames and you could see the smoke from everywhere in the city. It was crazy. Well, our friend Jonathan Cho over at Discovery Institute, who does reporting for fixhomelessness.org, he went to the encampment to check things out and also offered a little more insight into what was going on in that encampment and what happened there.
Friday morning, a fireball engulfed several trees and tents along I-5 in downtown Seattle. Inside a well-known homeless encampment entrenched on this Washington State Department of Transportation right-of-way.
Bunch of black smoke.
Witnesses say they heard propane tanks exploding.
We need to get these people off the streets.
Fire crews responded immediately and extinguished the flames. Authorities say one man suffered injuries from this inferno and checked himself into Harborview Medical Center. A hospital spokesperson says the victim is notorious graffiti vandal Casey Kane, also known as Eager. His tag was found on this sink, still standing in the wreckage. The 36-year-old was out on bail for vandalism-related charges.
How did this start?
I don't know. I just got here.
The Seattle Police Department Arson Bomb Squad is now investigating the circumstances around this mysterious fire.
I was asleep. I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything.
To get inside the encampment, there are two entrances. A broken fence near Harborview Medical Center at the corner of 7th Ave and James Street.
He's on BMX bike.
Or this opening off Yesler Way. This afternoon, you could see dozens of propane tanks scattered on the grounds. Scavengers were already picking through the debris.
Tremendous amount of wire from running from the generators that they were running in here, with wires, cameras, all kinds of shit. And I'm going to collect the wire. It's all copper.
And there are clearly more than 20 tents and structures remaining on site. So far, no comment from Governor Jay Inslee or Mayor Bruce Harrell. A WashDOT spokesperson referred me back to SPD. Earlier this year, another massive fire broke out just a few hundred feet away inside this encampment. Outreach workers have been here numerous times, but it's still unclear when WashDOT plans to move in and shut it down for good.
Yeah, and that's our friend Jonathan Cho with Discovery Institute. Check out his work, fixhomelessness.org. Follow him on Twitter, @ChoShow. So here's the thing. It would be one thing if this encampment was just one of the many, many fires that start in homeless encampments, in derelict RVs across the city. But Jonathan Cho, in speaking to his sources on the ground, you know, he's out in these homeless camps all the time, he is hearing that it might be even more nefarious than that, that the fire could have potentially been set intentionally over some drug war beef between apparently warring factions of homeless individuals. And Jonathan got a chance to ask Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell about that.
On the I-5 encampment fire last Friday, my sources are telling me it was related to a
drug turf war gone bad.
Yeah. I don't have the information there, Jonathan. We've talked publicly about in encampment areas the correlation between crime and hey Dale. <Dale. laughs>
Mary, they still love you here.
Well, we talked about the correlation between homelessness and drug addiction and crime and the overlap in these areas. And so I think people understand that there present safety issues. As a prime example of an unhealthy and an unsafe area that resulted in injuries and property destruction. So but we'll find out more information on this exactly what happened. That's what our police department will do.
Mayor, why not get permission from WashDOT and just go in and just clear this encampment that's in your city and obviously spilling into, you know, the neighborhood?
Well, we are working closely with them. Our relationship with the state officials, as evidenced by today, working with the commerce side of the house, that they understand the severity and the significance of the problems. They're keenly aware of it. They've taken their political and public hits because of perhaps not being as effective and efficient as they could be.
What are you doing to hold WashDOT accountable in your city?
Well, that's a good question. I don't couch it in terms of holding them accountable. I guess what the way I couch it is I'd be very direct in my expectations. I have to listen to the impediments that they have to work effectively. They could have human resource power, lack of employees, lack of resources themselves. So I also try to figure out what's their impediments, and then we move forward. So I think I made it very clear to them the significance of the problem. So I'm confident that moving forward would be a lot better.
But that display, so we'll talk about the two parts of the story, WashDOT and the state's mess over there when it comes to dealing with homelessness. But when it comes to the danger in the ruling, like the one this King County judge put down, where they're taking this real detailed look at, oh, what is an obstruction and does this tent constitute an obstruction? Meanwhile, you've got drug wars that are being fueled from inside homeless encampments. You've got homeless encampments that are the number one leading cause or tie to shootings in the city of Seattle. I don't care if the tent is a physical obstruction or not. I don't care if the tent is somewhere where I physically cannot get by it. I don't care if the tent is tucked away somewhere in a public park where, oh, technically it doesn't meet the definition of obstruction. There is so much more at stake than whether the tent is a physical barrier for someone to move down a sidewalk or to play in a park. These tents have links to the drug crisis. These tents have links to the crime crisis. Is every single homeless person a criminal? No. But I would also argue for those of you who have an issue with talking about the link between crime and homelessness, that people living in tents are more likely to be the victims of crime as well. So if you really care about them, you shouldn't want them living in tents. We have more than enough services. Lord knows we have more than enough money that is spent on services where we shouldn't have to have anyone living in tents. So the whole idea that we need to sit here and nitpick laws and wording in laws to decide before we can sweep a tent out of the way is absurd. We spend more than enough money to get these individuals out of tents. And for the ones who don't want to get out of tents, it's either because they're mentally ill or they're drug addicted. And those are crises you can only blame on the party that has been in charge, by and large, for 40 years in this state. So that issue aside, turning to the mess that is the state of Washington. So you have Governor Jay Inslee that made this pledge that we're going to do more to sweep these tent cities or encampments that are forming on state property. Because this is a real annoyance for a lot of cities, not just Seattle. This happened in Spokane. At one point, the largest homeless encampment in Washington was in Spokane, which Spokane had the political will to clear it, but it was WashDOT property. There wasn't a dang thing that they could do about it. And so it got so much attention that finally, you know, the state's like, oh, we got to, you know, get this out of there. But anyway, it sets up this weird dynamic where clearly the fire that happened over the weekend is having an impact on the city of Seattle. I mean, it's dead center in the city of Seattle, right by a hospital. I mean, for the love, if that hospital had caught fire. And yet, the city of Seattle is almost powerless to do anything about it because it is WashDOT property. So Jonathan Cho, again, I'm going to tick through some of these great interviews he was able to capture. One of them with the director of the State Department of Commerce, where he asked him, like, hey, why aren't these clearings being done more quickly?
Well, you guys have allocated millions of dollars for encampment cleanups on state right-of-ways, yet there was a fire, a massive explosion on Friday. Do you feel like the pace is adequate? Does this need to happen quicker? What's going on?
Well, we got to do more. I mean, there's no question that the resources are not sufficient to address all the challenges we have around homelessness.
You said you needed more money, but you guys have given millions already. How much more is needed, sir, to clear this encampment here in Seattle?
Well, until we address some upstream challenges around income affordability and other issues that, behavioral health, mental health challenges, other issues, then, you know, the investments on this end of the equation are simply not going to be sufficient to address the broader set of challenges that come with homelessness.
First of all, I don't know what income affordability is, but he's talking about, oh, well, we have to, before we can really invest money in dealing with some of these challenges that are happening, we have to fix, you know, the other issues upstream. We have to fix the mental health issue and poverty. It's like, again, who has been in charge for the last 11 years in the governor's office? The same person, Governor Jay Inslee. So if you have significant challenges that are making it problematic for you to be able to go in and sweep homeless encampments, first of all, the encampments have gotten bigger under Jay Inslee's leadership. Our mental health system has gotten substantially worse under his leadership. That's undeniable. Western State Hospital lost its federal accreditation. And if you're talking about a lack of affordable housing, how much affordable housing has Inslee been able to build in 11 years? And that's not the issue, by the way. That's not why people are in encampments. It's the drug crisis, which has also gotten worse under Jay Inslee's leadership. And it's interesting that the director of the State Department of Commerce, who serves at the pleasure of Governor Jay Inslee, wouldn't put the blame where it belongs on Governor Jay Inslee and Democrats who have had a trifecta in Olympia for the past 7 years, but I digress. So Cho also was able to, this was a couple weeks ago, actually, so it was before the fire happened in Seattle in this homeless encampment. He had caught up with Governor Inslee, had to kind of ambush him at an event and asked him about this very issue of not clearing homeless encampments from state property in a timely manner.
You talked about the importance of speed. Right now, last check, according to Commerce website, only 22 encampments have been closed since this right-of-way initiative started. That's fewer than two encampments being closed a month. Is that an adequate pace?
We're making really good progress on this. I'm very happy about our progress. We've had 800 people come in for housing since we started this. It's more than any other governor's done in the history of the state of Washington. We're going to continue this progress.
We've made really good progress on this. You haven't made really good progress. You clearly haven't made really good progress. And thank God that Jonathan Cho goes and tracks down people like Governor Jay Inslee to ask him questions about this, because Lord knows no one else in the media is holding him accountable for not actually making good progress on this issue. It's all wild. This is wild stuff. You know, Ann Davison, the Seattle City Attorney, tweeted out in response to this fire, you know, when is it enough? That is such a common sense question to ask at this point. When you look again at all the things that result and are tied to the homeless crisis, the drug crisis, the selling, how many times have we talked to We Heart Seattle, the volunteer group that goes out and sweeps homeless encampments and tries to get people into services? How many times have they shown us that they'll go to a homeless encampment? Half the tents don't even have someone living there. They're used to sell drugs out of. So you have the drug crisis that's being fueled by and from homeless encampments. You have the crime crisis that has a direct link to homeless encampments. You have fires springing up all over the city, this one right along Interstate 5 near a hospital. The idea that we need to pussyfoot around this issue and that you can't throw everything you have at clearing every single homeless encampment while simultaneously offering people access to services at this point is simply absurd. It is nonsensical. Nobody is saying just sweep these encampments from place to place. Just go in and move them every 2 hours. But we are saying that if you have individuals who repeatedly refuse access to services, no camp is swept without offering access to services. If you have people who repeatedly refuse it, then they cannot be made to feel comfortable being in a tent in our city, in our state. That's the bottom line, because I would be willing to bet, more likely than not, they are using that tent to facilitate illegal behavior. And so this whole, you know, oh, kid gloves with the homeless encampments, it's dangerous, it's deadly, it's absurd, it defies common sense. Again, brings me back to, for the love of God, Seattle voters who have common sense, fill out your ballot before the primary. And for those who have struggled to show common sense, ask yourself what kind of city you want. ask yourself if what's happening on our streets is reflective of common sense, is reflective of empathy. Absolutely absurd. Okay, coming up next, our friend Jason Rance is going to join us to talk about his new book, What's Killing America? Speaking about some of these policies around homelessness and substance abuse. That is going to be a topic of conversation as we discuss his book. But first, we've been talking about our friends over at First Mark Insurance, firstmarkinsurance.com. Mike and I took the First Mark Challenge in the spring. We're so glad we did. It didn't cost us anything, just cost us a little bit of time. Dave Taylor and his team at First Mark went and looked through all of our current insurance, talked to us about our insurance needs, went out again for free, shopped the market for us, came back and said, hey, here's what we think you need. And Mike and I now have much better insurance for the same price. Complete no-brainer. Again, here's Dave Taylor. He's the CEO of First Mark, talking about really how he would convince people who haven't done it already to take the First Mark Challenge.
The First Mark Challenge, it's simple from a consumer standpoint, right? It's simple, it's free, it doesn't take very much time, and it's going to help you feel confident about your coverage one way or another. And you said earlier, low pressure. We are no pressure, right? At the end of the day, when we get done and we look at that spreadsheet, we're going to tell you, you're going to see the facts in front of you. It's going to be real obvious to you what the right decision is. But our job is to make recommendations. It's our client's job to decide. And we're going to support them whichever way they go.
Yeah. And here's the other thing. I'm handing you an opportunity to save some money right now with the price of gasoline, which we're going to discuss in a segment coming up, and also the new long-term care tax, the deduction that's being taken out of your paychecks for that. Nicole and I met a woman the other day who's saving $100 a month after switching to First Mark or getting her insurance through First Mark. That's $1,200 a year. So just try the First Mark Challenge. It's free. It just takes a little bit of your time, and you could walk away with much better insurance and be saving money in the process. So it's a complete no-brainer. FirstMarkInsurance.com. FirstMarkInsurance.com, wonderful veteran-owned local company. FirstMarkInsurance.com, they work for you. All right, our friend Jason Rance, he's been just harassing me. He's like, Brandy, I want to come in. I want to talk to you about my new book. And of course, we love Jason Rance. He's a host at 770 KTTH in Seattle. He's also a frequent guest on Fox News. And he has written his first book. It is available for pre-order right now. It is going to be released at the end of September. It's called What's Killing America? Jason was nice enough to stop by to not only talk to us about his book, but also we discussed on the show yesterday the dangerously low staffing levels that SPD had over this past weekend. And Jason had some exclusive reporting this morning on that. Jason Rance, welcome to Undivided.
Thank you. It's been a while.
It has.
I've never been on the show.
Yes, you have.
You've never invited me into the studio. Not in the studio.
Well, that's because you're busy.
That's true.
Doing Fox stuff and your regular job and writing a book.
Important.
Yeah, so we'll talk about your book coming up momentarily, but some sort of news of the day stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We talked on the show yesterday about how SPD had some dangerously low staffing over this past weekend when there was a lot going on. There was a lot of events going on. There was a lot of crime happening. You're reporting that some of that might have been intentional sick outs?
Yeah, there was an uncoordinated sick out. There were a number of officers who either called in sick or did not show up for their shift on Saturday. And the word that was going out was that this was sort of an uncoordinated, but kind of, it wasn't like an official sick out because those are illegal. You can't actually do that. And so it seemed like word got out that some people were getting frustrated and they decided to take out their frustrations on that particular Saturday. I think that they were well-intentioned, certainly. You have officers who have been put on this blue-gold shift during the All-Star Week, working 12-hour shifts, not able to take any time off, only to then get put on even more of a crazy schedule because of all the events over the weekend. And so I think that for some officers, it culminated to a little bit too much. And I think that there's a severe burnout factor when you're asking that much of officers in a department that's already understaffed.
Yeah, I'm torn about this because I agree with you on how they've been treated. They're stretched thin. I have no doubt about that. But isn't it kind of playing politics with public safety to say, I'm feeling fine, but I'm not going to come in?
No, because I don't know if you can say they're feeling fine when they've worked as long hours as they have. I mean, at some point, you have to understand, and you know this, that officers, if you're not on the top of your game, you are a danger to yourself, your partner, and the community. And I think it's smart if you're already feeling like, I just can't do this again. I need some time off. I think it's the smart thing to do.
Well, then that's a legitimate sick call then.
It is, but when you're all doing it at around the same time, it then takes on a slightly different posture, I guess, it sends a message. They're, of course, over at SPD and the mayor's office, they're downplaying it. They didn't respond to any requests over the weekend. And then yesterday they came out and basically said, oh, no, it was not a sick out. Those reports are false. But we did have an unusual number of people who called in sick.
Well, you'd have to have people admit to, yeah, I called out.
They certainly know that the staffing was down. It was clearly a problem over the weekend.
Yeah, but you've been following closer than anyone the ebb and flow of the staffing numbers since really pre the summer of 2020.
When I was told that I was making the story up.
Yes.
There's no mass exodus of officers. The Stranger did this big takedown. King 5 fact-checked me by just saying I was wrong and not actually providing any facts. And I was right the entire time. I warned that this was happening. It was clear that it was happening, but no one wanted to admit it.
Well, and I think what's bothersome about that is you're right. You were reporting on that and looking at the numbers and the exit interviews before it was kind of mainstreamed by the corporate media. And you were reporting on it at a time when arguably things could have been done to stop the exodus.
100%. I mean, a lot of the exodus was due to, at the time, a lack of a fair contract, at least as perceived by officers, but also just the demonization of cops that was starting before George Floyd.
Yeah.
It escalated after George Floyd, and the council took significant action in defunding, which obviously pushed a lot of officers out. And then you have the national landscape, the narrative around policing that also got people sort of worried about staying in this profession. A lot of them left. Some went to cities and states that are more friendly to police officers. Mm-hmm. So a lot went to Idaho, a lot went to Texas and Florida and Tennessee.
What do you hear from the officers? You're very well sourced at SPD. What do you hear from the officers who are here still despite all of that and despite the stretch on their time right now?
They're all pretty consistent in complaining about the situation, and they keep asking how much longer they can put up with this. It seems completely untenable. And they're right. It is, from a staffing perspective, it is untenable. I'll have numbers out next week. The numbers are continuing to go down. The recruitment is not anywhere near where it's supposed to be. And on top of that, and this is a little sneak peek at one of the stories I'm working on, you know, you have a retention and recruitment plan that's not been implemented. You've got new recruits who are very clearly not qualified to be cops, and we are lowering the standards. The standards to become an officer in Seattle is much lower than it once was. And the warning signs not only are there, but are kind of being deflected. So we'll give you another month of training. Well, I mean, at some point, you're either fit for this job or you're not. And it's okay to say someone's not, even when you're in the middle of a staffing crisis, because you don't want someone who's going to be a danger to themselves, their partner, or the community going through.
Well, and it's fascinating because that's the opposite outcome that activists and everybody said they wanted. I mean, if you take away the totally dismantled police and get rid of them activists, people were like, oh, we need officers to have better training and be better able to deal with these situations. And as a result of the vitriol you hurled at officers, now the good ones don't want to be cops. And you have to lower your standards. So it's just
Only do you have to lower your standards, but you're doing that at the same time that you're losing your veteran officers, right?
Yeah.
So the people who have the most experience, the most community know-how and knowledge, they are leaving. Some are being pushed out. Some are just leaving because they can't do it anymore. And some are just retiring. We have a serious problem with retirement right now. You have a number of officers, including in King County Sheriff's Office, who are up for retirement this year or next year. And if they were all to leave, we do not have a police force that's functioning.
Yeah. So we're going to talk in a second about what's killing America and some of our cities like Seattle and up and down the West Coast. But, you know, crime is an issue. Obviously, homelessness is an issue. Substance abuse is an issue. So on the policing front, I don't see this problem getting better anytime soon. But when you look at how that low staffing is impacting our ability to contend with all those other issues that are killing some of our cities, how big of an impact does that have?
Well, it's weird because I don't think it has that big of an impact because I don't think they would be allowed to get involved even if they had the staff, right? I mean, we're telling cops not to get really involved in homelessness and drug addicts, even when they're breaking the law. And when you tell them that, I guess it doesn't matter how many officers you have. The real issue with staffing right now are all the other crimes. The break-ins that, yes, are tied to homelessness, but they don't have enough people to respond. There was a moment over the weekend in which there were Priority One calls that were being put on hold.
And tell people what a Priority One
Priority One call is the, as it sounds, it's a top priority. This is a incident that requires an officer immediately. It's due to potential loss of life or the potential for something to get violent. And those were waiting for cars. There was a shooting over the weekend in which in West Seattle, they had to bring officers from the North Precinct to go over there to help. I mean, that's how bad it was. So you've got two competing issues. You've got the homelessness-related crimes and the drug-related crimes. And then you have the violent crime that too many people in the city are still pretending isn't real. They're like, oh, it's not the 80s. Yeah. Well, yeah, no kidding. It's not the 80s. Yeah, and I love those arguments because in researching my book, you know, I go through all of these different cities. And yeah, Seattle is not comparing itself to Chicago or Detroit or anywhere else. We're comparing it to Seattle just a few years ago. And when you start to see a clear decline in quality of life and a clear surge in crimes, it's on all of us to say, whoa, 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 let's slow down a little bit and see so we don't get to where it was in the 80s.
Yeah, I hope nobody wants to be in a place where being compared to a Chicago or a Detroit.
You remember, so there was a Seattle Times piece, it was Gene Balk who wrote this, and it was at the early part of the crime surge during COVID. And he talked to one of the former Seattle police chiefs, said, oh, you know, things used to be so much worse. And this was when we were right in the heart of it getting as bad as we thought it could get. It turns out it wasn't as bad as it could have gotten. Yeah. But we're like, oh, no, it's just not the 80s. Yeah, yeah, I got that. Thank you. Yeah, thanks.
That's like great. And I don't understand the excuses for it if people claim to love the city. So talk about your book. How did this come about? Were you just like, hey, I want to write a book about what's killing America?
Yeah, so it's literally called What's Killing America because I see a whole bunch of policies that are, I think, responsible for big cities starting to lose their allure and in some cases completely losing their allure. I want to live in a big city. I want to live in a city like Seattle. And yet, you know, the things that drew me here to begin with are no longer a reality. It's no longer safe as it should be. It's no longer clean as it should be. And you start to see these themes happening all across the country. And so what I do in What's Killing America is I go through the big cities. It happens to be that they're run by Democrats. And I point to not just the policies that we're seeing get put in place, in some cases put in place before COVID, but a lot of it was escalated during COVID. And you can directly point to policy and say, this is the reaction.
Yeah.
This is the consequence. And you start to pick up on those themes. But beyond that, because I think it's important for us to push back, you have to understand why those policies don't work and why the people believe what they believe in pushing these policies. And so I explore that in great detail. You know, even on a radio show, you can only do so much in a single show. On TV, you get like 2.5 minutes, 3.5 minutes of time, and you fit as much into that as humanly possible. But a book actually allows you to go in depth and look at various topics. And so I cover not just crime, it's actually in two parts. So the first part, I generally describe it as, this is how the policies are impacting your life. This is what it's doing to you. Second part is, these are the policies that are telling you how to live your life. Mm. And so I talk about crime, homelessness, immigration, housing, transportation, taxes, and we go through all of it. And I give not just examples of what doesn't work, but I provide some solutions as what has been tried and does actually work.
Yeah. How much parity, when you look at cities like Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, New York, how much parity do you find in the types of policies that have resulted in these issues?
They're almost all the same. Hmm. I mean, there are versions of the same policy all across the country in these big liberal cities. And I think that that's intentional. It's being driven by ideology. The subtitle of the book mentions the radical left. I don't believe Democrats believe most of this stuff. I think the radical left does, and they've taken over the party, and they've taken the Democratic Party so far to the left that we're seeing the results, and you get bullied into taking these positions. And so what happens in Seattle ends up happening in Philadelphia. What happens in Boston is in New York. What happens in New York is in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And you're starting to see a little bit of a pushback, but not big enough.
Yeah. When you, people who watch this show, who listen to this show, obviously they follow politics quite a bit. They follow what's happening. They follow the issues that you're talking about. What do you hope that they can take away after reading it and kind of use in part of their conversation daily?
I want them to know specific examples of policy that fails, where it's happening, why it's failing, and why people believe what they believe. Because when you're having these conversations and you're trying to convince someone that it's not purely political, because most of these issues aren't inherently political. They become political. There's no doubt about that. But they're not inherently political. So when you're talking to your neighbor or family member, you're telling them, here's why they're doing this. They tell you that it's about compassion. Their policies around homelessness, for example. That may be what they believe, but understand, here's the result of this. And what I've been very critical of the media, both local and national, but local media in general. And this is the same, whether it's Seattle or Portland, New York or DC, they do not connect dots. They'll give you the transactional stories. Here's what happened. Here's a little bit about the why. But the why is because he got a gun. Well, how did he get that gun? Because I'm told we have all these gun control laws and that don't work. So I explain all of that. And so what I hope people get from it is just more information that you're just not generally getting from the media. And you're just not getting it. And some of that is intentional. Some of it is, like I said, laziness. You only have some time, so much time to do stories. And I get to have a lot more time because it's in a book.
Yeah, well, I think that's the important part about why people should buy it, who I think are going to agree with a lot of what you say in the book. It's because the people who are most need to read the book probably aren't going to.
Well, and the progressives. Thing is, here's what I say. Yeah. You buy two copies.
Yeah.
One, because it benefits me. But two, so you can give it to someone who deserves to read it. And again, I was very intentional about not labeling this as a Democrat issue. It is a radical left issue. And most Democrats are not radical leftists. And I think that they are sometimes fooled into believing, because of the way some people talk about the policies, that it's well-intentioned and it's going to lead to rainbows and sunshine. Yeah. But that's just not how it works. And I encourage people to read it who disagree. You can disagree with me. You can call me out. I've got about, I think, 70 pages worth of notes alone. So feel free, if you think I'm being dishonest about anything, go look up my source material. Call me out.
I'm looking forward to the stranger's review of your book.
Oh, I can't wait. You think they're going to read? Charles Mudede is going to do some long piece in iambic pentameter that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And it will be clear that he read a different book, not authored by me.
Yeah, very inside joke. The book comes out on September 23rd, right?
September 26th.
Well, because you were complaining that my wedding was getting in the way of your book tour. You're going to postpone it by one day
just
for my wedding?
Let's be clear. Yes, I have postponed my book tour, my travel, by one day. Aww. It was also a little bit cheaper. But I postponed it by one day so I can go to your wedding. And then the very next morning, rushing to get to the airport to go to New York, then D.C., San Francisco, and then back here.
Well, I'm honored. The book doesn't come out till the 26th, but people can pre-order.
Yes, pre-orders are so incredibly important when it comes to books like this, especially conservative content. As most people probably have seen, Target is going after conservative books. Mm-hmm. They banned Mark Levin's book. They walked that back, but then they just banned Glenn Beck's book. So we have to send a message. When you sell books early, it gets into their algorithm. I recommend Amazon, but you can get it at barnesandnoble.com, walmart.com. Purchase the book. It's called What's Killing America.
Congratulations. That's really exciting.
Thank you.
Jason Rantz, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So there you have it, our conversation with Jason Rantz about his book, What's Killing America, Inside the Radical Left's Tragic Destruction of Our Cities. And I'm glad that he specifies, you know, when he talks about the radical left. I think it's important, and it's important as part of this show, to recognize that you have so many Democrats who I don't think inherently agree with some of these policies, but for some reason you have this fringe of their party that has this outsized influence because, how do I put this in a way that's, I don't care if I'm offensive, actually, because they use these tools like talking about issues around equity and race and gender, and they use those tools and those narratives to almost guilt the more reasonable side of their party into going along with ideas that they otherwise wouldn't have, because they're like, well, gosh, I'm not racist, you know, I'm not sexist or whatever it is, and they're like, well, if they're saying that this needs to be done because if we don't do it, it's racist, whatever, then I guess I got to do it too, and I really think that that's a huge, huge part of it. So again, the book is What's Killing America, and as Jason said, it's important to pre-order if you'd like to get the book because it works well for the algorithm. And if we want to help Jason with anything, it's his algorithm. Very kind of him to delay his book tour for the sake of my wedding. That is a true friend. All right, coming up next, Governor Inslee's office really cannot get it together with what their story is going to be on the high gas prices, highest in the nation, and who exactly is to blame for the extent of those gas prices. We'll have that in our segment, Unbelievable. But first, we've been talking about our friend Wes Jones, wonderful real estate agent in our area. He's been doing it here for a long time. He and his team have an innovative marketing strategy to make sure that, one, the most eyeballs get on your listing, which is always a good thing when it comes to offers coming in, but also to make sure that your home is ready to hit the market. And that could include helping you with updates that you might need in order to make sure it's in tip-top shape. It is something they call the Listing Boost Concierge Service.
So we're going to come in, number one, and we're going to inspect a home, do a pre-inspection. We're going to find out all those little hidden bugs that, you know, a buyer may be concerned with. And if a seller wants to do some cosmetic updates, you know, whether it's flooring, whether it's lighting, countertops, even a kitchen, we're going to help guide them through that. So the Listing Boost Concierge Service, what we can do is we can project manage those rehab projects. We have a list of contractors and preferred vendors that we like to work with and have a ton of experience with, and we'll take that off a seller's hands. We'll go ahead and run that project for them, and we even have some options where they can pay at closing out of their net proceeds.
Yeah, which is really cool. It takes a lot of the stress out of the home selling process. So if you're in the market to sell your home, you're thinking about it, go ahead, check out a few real estate agents, but make sure to check out our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. Okay, we're actually going to do a little back-to-back unbelievable today because there was a story that somebody just told us about in the comments. And I'm like, wow, that's unbelievable. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But for our first dose of unbelievable today, Jay Inslee's office is so confused by what their story is going to be on the high gas prices that even his own press secretary doesn't quite line up with Inslee's statements on the issue. Okay, Washington State has the highest gas prices in the nation. It doesn't appear to be changing, which tells us if it wasn't just some one-off weekly fluke where our prices outpaced California. No, this is probably here to stay unless something significant changes. And by something significant, I mean the Washington State carbon tax that Governor Jay Inslee championed. And he has had to change his story on this so many times. I mean, he hasn't had to. When you tell the truth the first time, you never have to change your story. But when you tell a lie, it's hard to remember the initial lie you told, and you have to keep adjusting it as reality changes. And so you might recall when Governor Inslee was pushing the cap and trade program, he said, oh, the impact to consumers at the pump will just be pennies. Pennies, if anything. And that hasn't been the case. As soon as the carbon auctions began at the beginning of this year, we saw the price per gallon shoot up, very much in line with what independent think tanks had said it was going to do. And so Inslee wasn't able to keep up this lie of, oh, the carbon tax isn't going to increase the price at the pump, because before long it was nearly 50 cents per gallon. And I mean, the man lies a lot, but even he wasn't able to maintain that lie. So he switched to blaming the greedy oil and gas companies for just, I don't know, sticking it to Washingtonians. Here's a clip. We've played it a couple of times, but I want to show you the progression of things. Here's what Governor Inslee told Cairo 7 News during an interview.
Would you agree that this could be a direct result of the oil companies passing the amount of money that they have to pay to the state on to you?
And yes, there is some of that. Now, much of it is not related to this law because the oil companies have shut down a major pipeline, allegedly for maintenance, although why they do it in the summer, I don't know. That has restrained supply, and that has been a significant reason for these recent cost increases. It's not all this law.
Okay, so it was, remember, it was just going to be a pennies impact, if anything. And then when you realize that it was going to be like half a dollar a gallon, oh, well, the pipeline. There's a pipeline that shut down, and apparently it's only impacting gas prices in Washington State. Well, now the governor is firmly in the camp of, okay, you know, the gas companies are now using the carbon tax as an excuse to gouge you at the pump. But here's what he said during a press conference a couple days ago.
The very industries that are causing this massive pollution are today gouging us in their oil and gas prices and trying to tell us that unless they continue to be able to gouge us for their prices, that they're going to go bankrupt. The spokesman for Chevron said the other day, about the fact that we're holding them accountable for their pollution, that it's not their job to go bankrupt. Well, I don't have a Nobel Prize in economics. I only have a Bachelor of Arts in Economics from the University of Washington. But I can tell you the oil and gas industry is not going bankrupt. Look at the profits they have made on our backs in the last couple of years. This is a graph showing the profits of this industry. If you look at the red, which is Exxon Oil, just as one example, they were making profits of $2.7 billion back in 2021 in the first quarter. Now in the first quarter of this year, they made $11.4 billion. They have had massive increases in profits. Their pricing has been rapacious. And you know what they're doing that money? They're giving it to their CEO. The CEO of Exxon Oil made $35 million a year last year while he's jacking up our prices through the roof. We have had a bellyful of this industry polluting our skies, damaging our children's health, and now making us pay twice with these absurd profits and absurd prices. And today we're saying this. We in Washington State will hold the oil and gas industry accountable for their pollution, and we will hold them accountable for their price gouging. And we're here to announce that this January, we will be taking action to introduce bills to both forcing them to show us their books in total so that we can really assess how bad they're gouging us. And we will not allow them to excuse their pollution, claiming they're going to go bankrupt. What a bunch of hogwash. This is the most profitable industry in human history. They dwarf profits from anywhere else. And one would think that companies would have 1 ounce of social responsibility instead of using excuses to try to increase their profits. We will not stand for that.
Okay. All right. Are we keeping up here? So first, there's going to be no impact by the carbon tax. No, prices won't increase at the pump. Okay. I can't tell that lie anymore. Something about a oil line, a gas line, something. That's what's to blame for this. Oh, I can't tell that lie anymore. So let's do the easy thing and just blame the greedy oil companies and how much they're paying their greedy executives. And we're not going to stand for it anymore. And the answer to this situation, which was created by the government, which was created by overregulation, we now say the answer to that is even more regulation, is even more government interference in that sector, is even more laws to regulate what they're doing. We think that that is going to have a positive impact on the prices that you and I are paying at the pump. Keep in mind all the while what the purpose of the policy was. It's to make you less likely to put gas in your car. I mean, that is the purpose of this policy, to reduce carbon emissions. So it is exactly what the intent of it was. What I thought was interesting is just a few moments after the governor gave that whole spiel, there was a reporter who asked the governor, yeah, but do you think that this could be, you know, the most obvious explanation that this could be those private companies passing along the increased cost to them, to consumers, as any other enterprise would? And here's what the governor said.
Are passing on those added costs to the creditors.
Well, they're not passing on. This is profit on top of everything they spend, folks. This is $35 million bonus to the Exxon CEO when he went from $2 billion profit to $11 billion. They're not just passing it on. They're padding their pockets with this. And that's what's outrageous. They haven't just increased their numbers because of the cap and trade, which, by the way, have always been high in the Northwest because we are kind of an island of supply.
So then he goes around, turns around, says, oh, no, they're not passing it on. After he said in the Cairo 7 interview, yeah, there's a little bit of that happening. Given the fact that it's completely undeniable that they're passing it on, the oil and gas company has said, we're passing it on. He says, oh, no, it's not about them passing it on. It's about them using this as an excuse to pad their pockets. But again, common sense tells us, when you increase costs for any industry, that is going to be passed along to consumers. It doesn't make them greedy. It makes them a business. You increase their cost of doing business. Of course, they're going to pass it along to consumers, and that's what you intended all along. But I would note that the governor's own staff can't even keep up with what the governor is saying on this issue. Mike Falk, who's the governor's press secretary, the Center Square, did an article, Washington stabilized as nation's most expensive fuel following cap and trade. They write, his own spokesperson, Mike Falk, disagrees with the governor. That last statement we just played from the governor on, oh, they're not passing along, they're just padding their pockets. The quote from Mike Falk is, the governor does not deny that the Climate Commitment Act's cost impacts are likely more than the projections he based his past comments on. The projections did not anticipate the oil companies trying to pass along as much vaguely defined compliance cost onto the consumer. So again, when you can't get your story straight, it's probably because you're telling a bunch of lies. If you tell the truth to begin with, then you never have to change your story because the truth does not change. And what's happening at the governor's office is a perfect indication of that. Okay, can we fit in, Nicole, a second unbelievable story based on this unbelievable story brought to us by a commenter of the live stream? Go ahead. Apparently I'm wrong. Nicole says, actually, it was me. I saw a comment about this in the live stream, so I just assumed that you also saw that comment and then went in search of the story. So of our wonderful commenters, great minds think alike.
I guess.
Just because we're talking about the homelessness debacle, and you can come on to this, Nicole, nobody's even seen your face today. I've just been ranting and raving, and I'm very like Ben Shapiro today, talking way too fast. Sorry.
No, I think you got it. Otherwise, we'd have a two-hour show today.
Yeah,
we have a lot
to fit in. But we're talking about the homelessness disaster. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest disasters in our homelessness response has been the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, which spends hundreds of millions of dollars to do nothing. And their first CEO, Mark Dones, you'll recall, he announced he was going to resign.
Right.
And, you know, he said it was because of burnout. Meanwhile, he's making like, what, $260,000
a year or something.
So much money. Crazy, $245,000. But it was after all these stories about how under his leadership, they couldn't do the basics. They couldn't even get their contractors paid on time. And they had people left, right, and center like, do we even need you anymore? So universally condemned for the performance of the King County Regional Homelessness Authority under his leadership.
Unable to perform, right?
Right. Basic stuff.
Yeah.
So get this. And we'll talk more about this tomorrow because it just came up today. The Regional Homelessness Authority and former CEO move on after the breakup. Get this. The city just hired him. Oh.
Of course they would.
Oh, my God. So the city of Seattle just hired him.
Because he's probably got a friend.
Oh, for the love. It's for a $60,000 contract that expires at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's for less than 6 months. He's going to be paid $250 an hour. The contract says it's
$250 an hour. What is that for? What expertise is that for? What
expertise in a failing, I guess he's
service.
He has a lot of expertise in the homeless industrial complex.
Yeah.
Master.
No.
So he's expected to do 240 hours of work. And again, he's going to get $60,000 for just a few months' work. $250 an hour. This is unbelievable. And it says that what he's going to do is help Seattle leverage its Medicare funding for the homeless response better.
Yeah.
The contract, it says, city spokesperson Jamie Howson wrote in an email that the contract was with the city because the authority was, quote, engaged on other key issues. He wrote that the city and the county jointly requested the work Dones is completing.
This is it infuriates me that we're giving him more money.
It says, through their consulting business, Gray Sky Policy, Doan signed a 6-month contract with Seattle's Human Services Department to help the region maximize Medicaid funding for homelessness services. You couldn't find anyone else besides a failed homelessness authority CEO who was already overpaid by the county to do that work. And you expect magically, after his burnout period, apparently, when you're making $250,000 a year and that's just too difficult to do that work, you're now expecting him to not be burned out the next 6 months while you're relying on him and paying him a lot of money, just like he was making before, to do this work for the homelessness authority.
It doesn't even really make sense what he's doing. He's just telling people how to fill out the forms better to maximize their coverage. I don't understand it. It's ridiculous.
How about you maximize funding for homelessness services by not paying people bloated contracts and bloated salaries who have proven to be failures in that exact line of work?
I hope Jonathan Cho asks Harold about that next time he sees them. I'm like infuriated.
It's like, you know what it reminds me of? I know we're going long today. You know what it reminds me of?
Oh.
When they hired the former pimp.
Yes.
To be the street czar.
Because he wasn't good at the first job, so we'll give him something else. Maybe he's better suited for that.
And look, Andre Taylor and I get along fine.
Yeah.
You know, he was like a police activist. We had him on when I was at Fox 13 all the time. But
they hired him.
They gave him this lucrative contract to be a street czar, to connect police to the communities they serve. He ends up just being sick for a big chunk of that contract. They never renewed it, like canceled it very quietly, but no work got done. Nothing was done to show, like there was nothing to show for it.
This is crazy. That's unbelievable. We're going to talk more about that tomorrow because we can't do it justice today in the time that we have left. Wild, wild, double dose of unbelievable. Okay, I've been talking about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic, and I've heard from so many of you who have had success on the program, like I have, down 36 pounds on the program. I've met several people who have started it at the meet and greets that we had. Ben and his wife, Leslie, were at our Arlington meet and greet, and we posed for a picture together, and we added up our collective weight loss in just 6 months combined on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan. We're down 101 pounds.
That's a lot of pounds.
That's like a teenager.
So I always picture Oprah's wagon full of fat.
I don't know what you're referring to. I wasn't a fan of the Oprah Winfrey show. Sorry.
No, no.
101 pounds is a lot. And so it's just been great to hear those stories. And look, no meaningful weight loss plan is going to be easy. And the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan isn't easy either. But I like the fact that it's structured. They keep it super simple. So you know exactly what you can do and what you can't do. And I've been able to keep the weight off. I lost most of that in just 2 months. And the plan for maintenance to me is really easy to follow and just fits into your lifestyle. So do what I did. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team. You can do that virtually. You can do the whole program virtually. You never have to step foot in an office. Just go to eastsideweightlossclinic.com. That's eastsideweightlossclinic.com. All right, I had to fit this story in because any stories about dogs, I'm just so torn on what to do. You could say I'm divided. My mind is divided on what to do, dipping outside of Washington State to the White House. President Joe Biden's dog has a biting problem. Apparently, it's a pretty significant biting problem. And this is a different dog. Remember their old dog, Major, that bit someone in the White House? And so they sent it to live with friends, essentially, which is super sad. Well, now they have this other dog. I think it's Hunter. Is the dog
Commander.
Name? Commander. Sorry. Oh,
I have such a name for dog after his son.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. I did not do that on purpose. Okay, yes. Biden's dog Commander has bitten Secret Service officers 10 times in 4 months, record show. That's according to the Associated Press. They write, on November 3rd, 2022, a Secret Service official emailed colleagues that Commander had bitten a uniformed officer twice on the upper right arm and thigh. Staff from the White House medical unit treated the officer and decided to have the individual taken to a hospital. The officer was hospitalized. It goes on to say, a note the following day added details about the attack, including that the officer who was bitten used a steel cart to protect himself from another attack. The officer later was placed on several days of restricted duty based on doctor's advice. The White House and the Secret Service appeared to play down the situation on Tuesday, but the latest incidents raised questions about why the Bidens brought another German Shepherd to the executive mansion and why the attacks continued. Okay, first of all, this isn't a German Shepherd problem. The Associated Press, is that a... I've never heard of, like, German Shepherds being, like, a problem with biting people.
Well, I mean, there's a reason that they're most often used
like
as canine cops and things like that, because they're good at biting and determining when to bite.
I've met many a German Shepherd who's never cornered me and bit me.
Yeah, no, I used to... take care of a German Shepherd often, and he never bit me. Although they are very protective. So if you're doing something that maybe they deem as dangerous or whatever to their owner, I could see them getting protective. But this seems odd, and I think it's probably not a good environment for the dog, and that's why this is happening.
And that's why I'm so torn. So, and Lucky's 25% German Shepherd. And she nibbles, but she doesn't bite. Uh-huh. She just nibbles me a little bit. Love nibbles. But here's, I'm torn on this, because I do think that if you're the president of the United States, and prior to that you were the vice president, prior to that you were a senator, you probably are like, want to be safe in your home, and maybe like you're used to having dogs that kind of serve in that guard dog capacity.
Which, yeah, if you didn't have security, like Secret Service surrounding you all the time.
So I'm not going to question why the Bidens want a dog and why they love this dog and all of that, but it is probably a really stressful environment for any dog.
Yeah.
To have that many people around all the time. I'm just torn on
it's selfish. It's selfish.
Oh, but
of the Bidens. I mean, I get it. They like the dog, but then the dog needs to stay in a home that it's safe for it and the people around it.
Yes. I think 10 times in 4 months is probably should have been deemed too many.
Right.
I just feel bad for the dog, not because it has Joe Biden as an owner. Well, I think Joe can do too much with the dog.
Well, he likes to pull tails, remember? So maybe I do feel sorry for the dog.
So anyway, I'm curious what you guys think should happen to the poor dog, Commander, not Hunter. Oh, man. Okay, let's get to questions and comments from the live stream, shall we? On the homelessness issue and the judge that says that some of these sweeps are unconstitutional because these tents aren't actually a physical obstruction. Crafty Grandma Crispy says, are we keeping a list of these judges that make ludicrous judgments so we can vote them out next time? Then Vicky asked, who is this judge? An Inslee appointee. Nicole did a little sleuthing. The judge is Superior Court Judge David Keenan. He was endorsed by the Seattle Times in 2016, but he was elected, ended up being elected in 2016, having served since then. And we didn't see any indication that he was an appointee who later got elected. We're still looking at that, mm-hmm. but we don't know if he was an appointee. But it is, you know, people just skim by the judge parts on their ballot sometimes. But it's really, I mean, we've talked so much about how critical these appointments are, these elections are, and how we need to do our research into these. Let me see here. Jason said, you know, I'm anti-sweep, obviously, but I will say, is this the same Jason that said I was speaking from privilege? Probably. Let me read that comment first. Jason says, as usual, you speak from privilege. You have no idea how bad it really is for homeless people. Okay, let me address that. So I appreciate your comment, Jason. Thank you for watching. First of all, I do have empathy. If you've watched the show before, you know my dad died homeless. I understand how complex those situations are. He had a lifetime of abuse. I also think he had undiagnosed mental health issues. So I do have empathy, but I also understand the complexity of the crisis. And for a long time when I was on TV, I reported out in homeless encampments, and I spent a lot of time talking to individuals who are homeless. And so I understand the issue better than I think you're giving me credit for, as like someone who now does political commentary from the comfort of a studio. But when you say, as usual, you speak from privilege. No, I'm speaking as someone who has a right to have an opinion on the matter, as does every single citizen of the state of Washington who pays taxes. And this is, I think, the tactic in the way that a lot of people on the far left and on the fringe left try to get other people to shut up. It's like, oh, you're speaking from privilege or whatever it is. It's like, no, I'm speaking as a taxpayer who has a right to enjoy the city that I live in, who has a right to use the parks that my tax money goes to fund, who has a right to feel safe downtown. Or you're speaking as a business owner who has a right to operate a business without someone passed out from a fentanyl overdose in the alcove to their store. And so the idea that you can't have an opinion on what's happening with the homeless crisis because you yourself are not homeless is absolutely ludicrous. If the only people we allowed to have an opinion on the matter were the homeless, where do you think the homeless situation would be? And obviously, their decisions have not led them to the best place in life. Do I think that some people who are homeless are simply down on their luck and have been dealt a really bad card in life? Sure. I think that that's accounts for probably a pretty small portion of the homeless population. I think by and large, you have some sort of underlying issue, mental health or substance abuse or both. So I reject the notion that you cannot, as someone with privilege, and I don't deny that, you know, I have a pretty comfortable life, but I reject the notion that people who have jobs and homes cannot speak to the homeless crisis and how it should be handled because they have privilege. I think that's ridiculous, and it's a way to get people to shut up, which I won't. But Jason said, you know, I'm anti-sweep, obviously, but I will say that one thing the city absolutely could do is crack down on the crime in and around encampments. Who says you have to sweep to deal with that particular externality? Externality? There are plenty of people out there who could use a trip to jail. Not the majority, but there are a few individuals that make life more difficult, both for the homeless and everyone around them. And I agree. I mean, we'll agree on that I think there should be a lot more enforcement of crime in general, but that requires adequate police staffing, which there isn't. We barely have enough police staffing to respond to level 1 priority calls, life and death emergencies. We certainly don't have enough police staffing to be proactively out patrolling around homeless encampments, and the activists have said they don't want police doing that anyway. And so it's like, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it too and say, oh, police are bad. But hey, police, could you come and protect these homeless individuals and do patrols out here? It doesn't work both ways. All right. Matthew says, I talked to an SPD lieutenant a few years ago who told me 90% of property stored after sweeps is never claimed. It costs the city around $1 million a year to manage storage. And this is pretty ridiculous. I'm torn on this as well. The city will take all the stuff from a sweep and provide a storage facility for it. And then people never come back for it, and half it is just trash. And I understand that someone else's trash might be someone else's treasure or whatever it is, but I think there needs to be a little more strict policy on what gets stored and for how long that stuff is stored. Sergeant Pickles with a super chat says, good afternoon. The next election cycle will go a long way to deciding if my family moves out of state. Hope it improves. This is always home to me. And you also have that new baby boy to worry about. And so I think that that's part of it as well is, you know, you might love it, but is it a place where you want to raise a child? And I don't fault anyone for making a decision like that based on what's best for their kids. Little Tyke, I haven't heard a comment from Little Tyke before, but Little Tyke with the $19.69 super chat. I wonder if 1969 has a special meaning.
I mean, there's the song.
What
Summer
is the
song?
Summer of 69. Oh, I think that song's actually about 1869. It was one of the best summers. Little Tyke says, miss you, Dory. We do miss Dory. Do we ever talk about our crabbing adventure?
Yeah, we showed a picture, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we went crabbing for Dory. We miss Dory, too.
Yes.
All right. Let me get a couple more here. On SPD and the staffing issues, and I asked you guys on the live chat whether you think SPD officers, is it wrong for SPD officers to stage a sick out? I think it's wrong. Mm-hmm. I think it's wrong. And you guys said on the live chat, 30% of you said yes, 70% said no. So this is an example of when I disagree with you guys and your answer on the poll in our live chat. I think it's wrong because I'm thinking about what's the worst case scenario if an officer calls in sick to make a point? Well, you could have someone die. You could have a shooting. You could have an innocent human being who calls 911 and has to wait an extra minute, 5 minutes, because staffing is low. I just think that's wrong. I think that's too far to make a political point. Bob Larson says, SPD has been losing numbers since the consent decree back 10, 12 years ago. That's true. That's when officers began feeling they had zero support locally and either retiring or leaving for other agencies. That is true, that there was an issue at that time, especially as the consent decree dragged on, and then it just continued in earnest in the summer of 2020. Let's see, Inslee and his, why are gas prices so high? I don't know who wrote this comment. I'm still waiting for my $30 car tabs, Jay. On the dog in the White House, Kathy.
I thought it was a good power out.
Oh, that's funny. I accidentally called their dog Commander Hunter. Kathy said, if you were bit by Hunter, you'd need a shot. Yeah, maybe not so much for the dog. Okay, that is a good comment to end on. Let's get to our closing sanity check quickly, shall we? X is here. X has arrived. The X factor. The X takeover. As suspected, Elon Musk has rebranded Twitter to X, just X. He tweeted out a picture of the new logo put up on their headquarters. First of all, let me say about the logo, if you haven't seen it already.
So boring.
Well, did a seven-year-old do that on paint?
Right.
It was like, they hyped up this reveal so much, and they were like, oh, you know, send me your ideas for the new logo. It's just an X. It's just an X. I was like, oh, some like intern in graphic design made that. But people are, as usual, anything Elon Musk does, they're freaking out about it. Either they really love it or they really hate it. I think for me, what's interesting is he wants to make it the everything app, right? He wants to make X like a place you can go and do almost everything you need to do on the internet. And so I think there's still a lot to be seen about what this brand change actually means in the long run. But I mean, I think it's kind of silly. I think it's silly to buy Twitter, a name that has universal recognition, and rebrand it to a letter, which you were pointing out, Nicole, you can't trademark because it's a letter of the alphabet.
I assume you can't. You can't.
Oh, you can't. You told me that earlier as if
it
was a fact.
Well, I'm pretty sure that you can't.
I don't think you can trademark a letter.
A letter, right. And so I think that you can't brand a letter. I mean, he can try to own it, and people will occasionally think of him when they're talking about X, but it's kind of dumb.
But
it's just dumb, and I normally support Elon's outside-the-box thinking not all the time, but a lot.
Like, look, I hate Twitter. Despise it.
It's the worst.
It drives me insane, and that's why it's in our sanity check.
And I appreciate he's trying to make it better.
But there's nothing better about it yet.
I think he's just shaking it up,
Look, you can't make it worse. You can't make it any worse than it already was. Twitter is terrible. So one of the things that concerns me and concerns...
Maybe that's the X.
For toxic.
Yeah.
X stands for toxic. For the sake of our sanity, I don't want Twitter, nor need Twitter, to become an everything app. I don't need to spend more time on Twitter X than I already do. I'm fine with it just being what it was, as big of a cesspool as it was. Mm-hmm. But I don't need this app to encompass any more of my life. For the sake of our sanity, Elon, for your sanity, and for everyone's sanity, please just keep it a platform where people give their terrible opinions. I don't need to spend a single second more on X than I already do.
The bird was cute.
The bird was cute. The X is not. Fine.
No. Boring.
It's insane. Mm. All right, that has been it for today's episode of Undivided. Reminder, we have an opportunity to get together this Saturday at the Summer Freedom Fest. I hope you'll join us. It is happening from 4 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at Willowcrest Stables in Redmond. I'll be sharing that graphic across my social media pages. Dave Reichert is going to be there. Sammy Bird is going to be there. Raul Garcia. It's being hosted by Brian Haywood. Our friend John Carlson is going to co-MC it with me. So we look forward to seeing you there. We'll also be debuting our Undivided swag, we think. That's the plan anyway. So we hope to see as many of you there as possible. Nicole will be there as well. As always, if you have not become a subscriber to the show already, please do so. Help support our mission and our movement to give common sense a comeback. We went 11 minutes over today. Sometimes that happens, you know. What are you going to do? We had a lot to talk about. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. We'll see you back on the live show tomorrow.